Hi, welcome to the Macro Show. We talk macro, and you wonder, why won't the SLR lead to banks selling treasuries? We're going to answer that question. We got economic data. We've got hedge fund positioning. And because, of course, bonds were up big today, I'm going to celebrate. It's not a huge victory, but we'll take every victory we can get. So I want to continue down this path of the SLR because there's a lot of confusion still. I want to get into kind of how this thing works a little bit deeper and show you some more data on it to help you understand, you know, what it is and why the banks aren't going to end up selling treasuries. In fact, we could argue ever since the announcement, bond prices have started going up. And even during the European hours where we've just seen this, you know, pounding on bonds, it weren't really successful last night. Now, one of the key things about the SLR rule, what it's intended to do, is lending, it comes with risk, right? I mean, and if you've ever loaned someone money, and probably everyone here is watching, you know, that has done that before, you may not have gotten all your money back or any of it back. And that comes with risk. And so, you know, banks have done a terrible job. I mean, we could argue this easily. They've done a terrible job of managing that risk. When they're given the free rein to lend, man, they let that kite out and we'll lend and lend and lend and we get financial crises. So the regulators have decided that since the banks can't effectively manage that risk very well, that we're going to put in additional rules to try to control them, to try to change their behavior, make them better lenders, and give them other alternatives, such as buying bonds that may be more attractive. And of course, from the government's perspective, really important since they need a dumping ground for all this debt they're issuing. So let's get into the SLR formula here and trying to understand, you know, what we're looking at, because I know a number of you have looked it up online and there's some confusion. So the supplementary leverage ratio formula is tier one capital divided by total leverage exposure. And tier one is, we're not even getting into what it is because it doesn't, it's common core equity. You can go look it up. The total leverage exposure is what we're more interested in because this is a denominator. And down here is all the stuff the bank does that the regulators consider risky, including treasury securities. So going into the exemption during the pandemic shutdown, the Fed said we're going to exclude treasuries and deposits at Federal Reserve member banks, which would be reserve assets, from the denominator to allow banks to do some more lending. That kind of was the idea. Now there's this fear that adding that back in is going to cause a problem and the banks are not going to be able to meet their SLR minimum and they're going to choose to sell the treasuries over reducing their loan book. That's what everyone believes. Is that entirely true? Well, I don't think so. Let's dig a little bit deeper because our focus here is on the G-SIBs, the large banks. And I tried to find a current list of them. I found an outdated list, but not a current list. But these are the large U.S. banks. So G-SIBs are also global systematic important banks are also subject to an enhanced supplementary leverage ratio, ESLR. And under the ESLR, G-SIB top tier bank holding companies must maintain an SLR ratio greater than 3 plus a leverage buffer of 2. So 3 plus 2, that gives you 5 to avoid limitations on the banking organization's capital distributions and certain discretionary bonus payments. And as we talked about last week, there's an additional level of 6%. If you achieve that, then everyone's really happy. So is there really a problem? Well, one way to find an answer is to actually look at the leverage ratios, and we can go to the Office of Financial Research. And here we see the most recent data, 2020, quarter three. I'm sure the Q4 will be out soon enough. And unfortunately, I cannot sort this list by just the G-SIB banks. So it's got all the banks here. And you can see we have ratios 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 7. Lowest one is 1. That was not a G-SIB. And you've got 5 and 6. So you see, based on the third quarter, you said, well, that doesn't appear to be a problem. But hey, we're excluding some things, so maybe we need to go backwards. All right, well, let's go to Q1, which would be the last quarter prior to the SLR exemption coming in place. And what do we see? Leverage ratios 15, 14, 12, 10, 9, 8. In fact, you start looking at this and you say, why did the Fed even need to do this? Did they need to do it? Well, it doesn't appear that they did. So the fact is that the banks were fine before all of this. And as we can see that even in the third quarter, they're doing fine. That bringing those back in is unlikely to change anything. So what is the, again, what is the point of all this? It's banking has risk, you know, lending has risk. How do we curtail that risk? And that's what the SLR is designed to do. So when a, you know, deposits come into a bank, what can a bank do with it? Well, they can either buy an interest generating asset, which would be a treasury security or of some sort, and turn that money into a reserve and collect the difference between what the bank is making on the treasury securities, on the yield, versus what they're required to pay depositors. They can also lend against that, right? And when they do that, they can make the spread there too. But the Basel III rules, the SLR rules, say, you're not really good at managing that risk, so we're going to penalize you every time you do a loan. Depending on the type of loan or the type of activity you do, there is a penalty, and that penalty is going to involve setting aside extra capital. So if you're looking at making a spread on a loan and you're penalized for that loan, what is going to happen to your spread? It's going to shrink, making that loan less attractive. That is the entire purpose of these, you know, regulatory rules. Banks, you have been very bad, and to make sure that you get punished properly, you're going to have to do this extra stuff, and that's going to reduce your profit. Now, because we need to dump a bunch of treasuries onto the market, we're also going to help you out by saying, if you wish to buy government debt, well, we're not going to penalize you for that at all. So when you compare what you're going to do, you know, a loan over here versus buy a treasury, maybe it'd be close where the spread on the treasury is a better deal and you can buy that and we won't penalize you. Now, if you think about that, what type of treasuries would banks want to buy? Would they buy very short-term ones, T-bills, where the interest rate is really small? Would they want to buy 30-year or long bonds where the interest rate is much larger because they know they're going to hold on to this longer? Well, let's go and look at what some of these penalties could be, because if we look, and we're going to go to the website US Basel III.com, and you can find the standardized risk weights tool provided by Davis Polk here, and you can see cash obviously has a 0% risk weight. But let's go to the next one: exposures to and portions of exposures that are directly and unconditionally guaranteed by the U.S. government, its agencies, and the Federal Reserve. That would be U.S. Treasury securities. It would also, you know, that is U.S. Treasury securities. And look at the risk weight: none, zero. It's saying you could, hey banks, you could buy all the treasuries you want, and you can collect that dividend on it without a penalty. But you want to do some other stuff? Well, how about you want to get some exposure to foreign banks? Yeah, there's going to be some penalties for that. You want corporate exposure? Well, penalize retail exposure, penalize. How about a residential mortgage? Yep, penalized for that too. So you can just go down the list and you can see there's all these penalties for doing others. Oh, you want to do over-the-counter derivatives? Sure, good luck with that. You're gonna have penalties for that. Collateralized transactions. I mean, you just go down the list. Everything you'll find there are penalties for. How about unsettled transactions? Yeah, those aren't good either. So that's the whole point of all this, is the notion that the banks are going to choose to keep some of these loans doesn't make a lot of sense. What makes sense is they're going to kind of restrict some of these things. And what do we mean by that? Well, if we're talking about margin loans, well, they can increase their margin requirements, or they can cut credit lines, or they can ask, you know, borrowers to pay back some of their credit lines. But the whole point of this is, if we look at their current leverage ratios, you see that there's plenty of margin built in there. The fact that, you know, this coming back to the formula is going to cause all of their leverage ratios to, you know, drop below 5 and force them to sell treasuries, you don't see it at all. So once you kind of get into the data and you understand the purpose of this from a regulatory standpoint, you realize that the banks probably aren't going to be selling bonds. They're probably actually going to start buying more, because the spread on a long bond now has become attractive, maybe because they helped drive it down when the exclusion hit, right? Remember, we looked at that 30-year yield chart where yields, you know, were flat and then fell, and then all of a sudden rose when the exemption went into play. So maybe the banks were dumping them to drive yields up so they could turn around and buy them back. We don't know, because we can't see the breakdown of the banks in terms of what they hold in treasury yield securities. But that's the whole idea of this. So this notion that, you know, the banks are going to be forced to sell the things, it just doesn't make any sense. And of course, when we look at the price action in the bond market since the announcement, it makes even less sense, because yields are falling. And now the banks have a little over a week before that rule goes back into place and they have to start factoring it. All right, let's take a look at the economic data. Not a whole lot today to look at, but definitely something worth looking at is, let's see, we've got the Chicago Fed National Activity Index, and what a surprise this is at -1.09. I could not have predicted this. Now, the Chicago Fed National Activity Index is a national index. It looks at the entire U.S. economy. We've looked at this, you know, every month, and what it's saying is at -1.09, that indicates a contraction or below average growth. You see what it says here, below average growth. Now, it seems kind of odd. We had the stimulus in December, and by February, we have a negative number. We haven't seen that since last year. Since early last year when we're going into the pandemic. So here we are, the economy is supposed to be recovering, and we've got a negative print. Now, I know some of you are saying, well, Steve, you can't look at just the one-month number. You're right. We have to look at the three-month moving average, because even the Chicago Fed says the monthly can be kind of noisy. Well, here is the three-month moving average, and it went to -0.2. So even it's saying below average growth. And as far as inflation, well, if you want inflation, you have to be 2 years into an economic expansion and have a number of over 0.7. So it tells you that, you know, no danger of inflation coming at all. Now, how about the existing home sales in February? Drops -6.6%, completely missed expectations, of -3% drop. What is this telling us? That higher interest rates, higher housing prices that came with this print are deterring potential home buyers. And I know some people say, nah, this is all weather related. This is a pretty big drop in February due to weather. So the idea here that, again, we're seeing this liquidity trap where higher prices, higher interest rates are being rejected. Now, along that line, because there's some concerns of the SLR coming back into place with the exemption expiring, that all of a sudden the Treasury auctions are going to go really bad, which is odd because I don't see that happening. But looks at today's 3 and 6 month bill auctions, they came in at lower yields. And so tomorrow, I think we have the 2 year. There's some people are nervous about that. I have zero expectation that there'll be any problems with that, mainly because the Fed's behind a lot of 2 years. Let's take a look at how hedge funds are positioned in the futures market. So we've got 10 year, they're slightly net long. They went from net short to slightly net long. And let's take a look at the 30 year, and they covered, you know, some of their positions. And of course, we've got from our friend Brent Johnson, Santiago Capital, saying they covered about a little over 35,000 positions. And here is his chart. Stefan had from Skyway just emailed me right before the show started. So we'll get to his charts probably on Wednesday, see what he sent me. And let's continue on this, because one thing I'm interested in here on this long bond, as we go to the CFTC website, is here you see Treasury bonds. What is interesting in terms of asset manager and institutional positions, you see that they're holding, of the open interest, almost 42% of those are long. So asset managers, banks, institutional money managers, all the people that are holding these are very, very bullish. But look at how they're also hedging those positions. So 22% of the total position is held on a short side as they're protecting their downside risk. So I'm really interested in seeing how asset managers and banks start to back off their short positions, because I looked, and these are pretty sizable short positions. We see that hedge funds backed off quite a bit on theirs. Even looking at the ultra bond, you know, what do you see? Almost 56% of the long positions are held. Again, asset managers, banks, institutional money managers, and they're still got a sizable short at 26%. The speculators, the hedge funds, got a larger short position at 31% of the open interest, and they added to their positions there. So let's come back to that in a few minutes. Let's go back and see what else is going on here from Hedgeopia. No real change in West Texas Intermediate futures. How about S&P 500, slightly net short euro? Now, if you're bullish on gold, and then you want the euro to go up. If you're bearish on the dollar, you want the euro to go up. And look at the speculative positioning. Another week, they're backing off their positioning, suggesting downward pressure in the euro. And we'll, when that means for gold is they increase their long slightly, but that general trend in the euro should also be bearish for gold, since while gold does not always trade inverse to the dollar, it generally does frequently trade inverse to the dollar. No change on the NASDAQ shorts there. How about the Russell 2000? Ooh, big increase in long positions. Back on the stimulus check is going to be bullish for the U.S. Economy. How about what do we have here? Dollar. This is interesting. Now speculators are now long the dollar, setting up what could be a mega dollar rally. Massive short squeeze coming out of here. This would be bearish for U.S. equities, bullish for bonds, bearish for gold, bearish for oil. A lot of interesting things with the dollar. If it gets unwound, everything is going to change. How about fixed positioning? We see in the volatility space a little bit of short covering there, but still speculators are very, very short volatility. Perhaps a dangerous position with the SLR exclusion going away. Let's go back to the CFTC report here. I want to look at some more of these bond positioning, because what you see is this consistent view of, you know, asset managers are long, banks are long, two-year asset managers, 38% of open interest long, 20% short. Look at hedge funds, short 46% of the open interest. So, you know, they dropped a bunch of their contracts on the two-year, 84,000 contracts. Let's continue on. Look at the long positions on the 10-year. Asset managers hold 26% long, 26% short. So they're conflicted on their view here. So, you know, what am I going to be looking for in this data, you know, going forward? Are asset managers going to start backing off their shorts as they believe price is not going down anymore? That's what I'm really interested in. You see that speculators are long the 10-year. We saw that at 14% of open interest, short about 10%. How about the Ultra 10? Asset managers are long at 27%, short at 38, almost 39%. So you see not a lot of conviction. They're more short than long, and speculators are more long than short. Now, something you don't normally see, but again, I'm still looking for, when do the big players that are really long, which is across the board here, which is the asset managers, banks, institutions, when do they back off those shorts? How about 5-year? You see asset managers 40% long, 27% short, speculators 12.5% long, 22.5% short. So some interesting stuff going on there. Speaking of short positions, how about TLT? Well, massive short position here. You look at short interest is, you know, 21,000 shares out of an average volume, trading volume of 21 million shares. With average trading volume at 16 million shares, days to cover one, but given his normal trading volume, which is around 7 or 8 million, that you're talking about 3 days to cover. So massive short interest on the bonds, on the ETF, massive short interest in the futures market. And this is just a wildly short market that with any catalyst could get unwound. And maybe what we're going to see with the SLR rule is that banks are going to come back in and buy those 30-year and rein in some of that credit. And it would make a lot of sense. But now since you understand the leverage ratio a little bit more, you see where the banks are positioned, and you see why the regulators are doing it, you can also see why the likelihood of them dumping bonds, way overblown. With that, we'll be back on Wednesday for the macro show, and I've got an interview coming up this afternoon. Don't know when it'll be published for Cambridge House, so I'll let you know, as always, when that happens, and I'll have a supplemental newsletter for you on today's topic on Friday, provided I have it written. I just probably remembered to post it. Anyways, I'm Steve Van Meter. Thanks for watching. Thanks for being fans. We'll see you on Wednesday. Bye now. The content of this video is provided as educational information only. It's not intended to provide investment or other advice. This video is not to be construed as a recommendation or solicitation by or selling security, financial instrument, or to participate in any particular trading strategy. This video was prepared by Steve Van Meter, personal capacity. Opinions expressed in this video that do not reflect the view of Atlas Financial Advice, Inc. or Steve Van Meter Financial.